Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
Hello, this is Mary Robson, host of this edition of Nature Now. For the week of Father's Day in June, the weather has ranged from June gloom to sun. Who knows what the weekend will bring? Jackie Gardner will join me to highlight her work as a citizen science volunteer. We'll be talking about how she has helped with water studies and management here. But first, of course, let's hear the mystery sound. Here's a clue. This sound is famous in literature. That's going to help you a lot, right? Now we will do some observations, and Charlie Fleischman, as usual, will help me do these.
Two handsome cedar waxwings faced each other while perched on the same branch. The male offered the female a berry pulled from a mahogany bush. She accepted the berry. This is a good sign for the male. Violin music is needed for the movie version. After forming a bond, the two find a nesting spot and live monogamously.
And an amazing nest is made by a bush tit, a grassy woven pouch attached to a rose bush in a Port Townsend front yard has fascinated observers. It's about 8 inches long. Usually we see bush tits moving through trees in search of insects, but when they are nesting, they leave the flock and make a nest resembling a dangling sock out of moss and grass stems. This particular nest is like a sock in the shape of an L because the lower end of it rests on a branch. Building the nest can take up to a month. And people who write about this say helpers, including the male, work at building the nest along with the female. When it is complete, family members sleep in it along with the fledglings. When the baby birds can fly, everyone leaves the nest and sleeps on branches. And sometimes they reuse a nest because for a bird smaller than a chickadee to create something like this, I can see why you'd want to use it again. And flowers of the mountains. Summer is definitely here. The alpine and subalpine flowers are blooming off the Hurricane Hill Trail. About a week ago, I saw a number of them tucked into scree and rocks. There's creeping phlox in pink, white, and purple, Indian paintbrush just opening, and my favorite is the wonderfully named desert parsley. It's hunkered low to the ground like many of the subalpine flowers, which are saving moisture by staying low. The desert parsley has fragrant leaves that smell not at all like parsley and brilliant yellow flowers, and this early summer has brought mountain flowers into bloom all at once. So go and visit quickly while they're still there before they go to seed.
Gray jay. A gray jay famous for following people looking for food lived up to its reputation when one hiker gestured with a sandwich in hand. The sandwich was promptly snatched away by a swooping gray jay.
Now our interview with Jackie Gardner. When I spoke with Jackie recently, she said, "I'm harvesting greens for the food bank." Her community efforts make her retired status hardly accurate. She served as a pharmacy professor at the University of Washington, retiring from that post. Since moving to the Olympic Peninsula, she offers her time and interest in several different activities, loosely called citizen science. Each of these helps the native world thrive and connects her to active scientific institutions. And one definition of citizen science is that there is already a science experiment or report set up, and the citizen collects the data that fits into that existing report. Hi, Jackie. We're glad you're here today, and I did a little defining of citizen science by saying that the citizen collects the data, but it feeds into an established program. You may or may not agree with that, but if you want to kind of refer to it as we talk about what you've been doing, it may help people know a little bit more about what you're doing. The first thing I wanted to talk about was the trapping that you've been doing to look for invasive green crabs. Where do you do the work and with whom?
We have 8 volunteers on the Tuandos Peninsula, and we work in a beautiful estuary off of Daybob Bay. We've gotten permission from a homeowners association to go in once a month at the lowest tides from April through September. We place 6 baited traps in the water one day at a low tide and let them soak overnight, and then we come back the next morning, pick them up, and we identify what's in them, count what's in them, measure and identify the sex of crabs that are in them, and report back to Washington Sea Grant, which is the crab team that oversees the project.
How long have these green crabs been a peril in this area? Do you know?
Actually, they aren't yet a peril in this area, which is why we're so carefully monitoring them.
Uh-huh.
They came up from San Francisco up the coast from about 1989, and they've become a huge problem all along the coast. They haven't made it into the Salish Sea until a couple of years ago when they were found in Souk Harbor. They are elsewhere in Barkley Sound on Vancouver Island. But once they were made it to Souk Harbor, we began to be concerned because the eggs can float as plankton and could theoretically float across and land on the Olympic Peninsula or in Puget Sound. So the team began to be formed in 2015 for monitoring here, and our hope is that if any of them do come across, we are able to identify them quickly enough and eliminate them before they establish a foothold, because they're very efficient predators and will go after our clams and young crab.
So they could actually damage the existence of what's already there growing.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So we're very careful. So we haven't seen any. I have to tell you that our success so far is not finding any.
which is a wonderful, that's a good definition of what you're doing. We got no results,
exactly.
And we're delighted, right?
We're delighted. Lots of results, but none of them are green crabs.
How did you get trained to do this? I know that your work as a pharmacist, you obviously were familiar with science and protocols. Did you need that to help with the trapping, or how did you get trained?
We were trained according to standard protocol by the members of Washington Sea Grant. The project is funded by the Washington Fish and Wildlife with a grant from Environmental Protection Agency. And so Sea Grant is administering this through the University of Washington program, and they did all of our training so that we're all administering the same protocol in all the sites. And this is absolutely critical so that the data can be compared and generalized from site to site. So we have a protocol that we follow very religiously, and all of the equipment is provided by Sea Grant, right down to the gloves and 6 pre-packed packages of stinky mackerel, which is resting in my freezer right now.
So is this something that the green crab can't resist, or you don't know?
So far, we know that hairy shore crabs cannot resist it in huge numbers.
I was going to ask you furthermore about the trapping. You do this at low tide and retrieve the trap the next day?
That's right. In addition to the trapping that we're talking about, in conjunction with the program, we also are measuring and describing the adjacent shoreline and vegetation and the substrate so that we get a better idea of, if green crab arrive in this area, what is the environment that they prefer to have, so that we can intensify monitoring in those areas. And so we do the trapping and the counting, and we also do a transect survey of the shoreline, and we search for molts from all of the crabs in the area to see what species are there. So we're doing able then to do a really good characterization of what the environment is, so we'll know better what we have to contend with should they ever come. There are 3 sites, I think, here in Port Townsend area, ours and Tuandos, and there's one at Calla Point. And I think out on North Beach, maybe. I'm not sure about that. There is a wonderful website about this project and what is needed. If it makes sense, I'll give it to you. It's www.wsg, which stands for Washington Sea Grant, washington.edu/crabteam, C-R-A-B-T-E-A-M. They can check the website and volunteer.
That's great. Could somebody with no experience do this? I mean, in other words, say that somebody has some boots, but that's about as far as they've gotten in terms of water water work.
Boots is about all they'll need to participate in one of these trainings. You work in teams. You have a written protocol with instructions. You have some photographs for identification of all of the critters that you're likely to find, and not just green
grass. Oh, that's a help.
How to identify them. Yeah, colored photographs and identification markers and things to count, bumps to count, and so on. So training is one day, but very extensive, and then you have a lot of support from the crab team and from each other, and it's a fun event.
Well, when you pick up a trap, what is likely to be in it? I mean, that's just in a sort of a general range of things.
In our site, the 99% of the critters in our traps are hairy shore crabs, those little tiny crabs that you see when you're walking on the beach at low tide and turn over rocks. Those are hairy shore crabs.
They're smaller than a quarter.
Yeah, generally that's true. We also get snails and the occasional bottom fish, a sculpin, will go in sometimes. And like this past week, we had some hermit crabs, which are always very cute. So far, that's been the majority of what we find. In the molt survey, we've seen red rock crabs and Dungeness crabs, as well as hairy shore crabs and some others, graceful crabs.
The entire contents of the trap go to be studied?
We do the count, then we release them back into the water. We suspect, although we don't have proof, that we catch the same ones over and over again, and we think they probably think of us as that mackerel food truck that pulls up once a month for an overnight feed.
Right.
Look forward to it.
They're probably up for that, right.
They probably have rituals built around it.
Well, what I wanted to add for people listening is that later this year, our producer, Nan Evans, is going to go out with the green crab trappers and do a report. So listen for lots more information on that. And we'll step into the next service that you've done, which is checking for toxins in Lower Discovery Bay. Where do you work on this and with whom?
This is a project of Sound Toxins, which is a huge collaborative effort of government, tribes, shellfish producers, lots of volunteer citizen scientists around Washington State. Sound Toxins has 31 sites in Puget Sound. Four of them work out of the Marine Science Center in Port Townsend. And we do this work in Discovery Bay. There also are sites at Fort Worden and at Port Townsend and at Mystery Bay.
Okay.
The process is that we go to Discovery Bay, to a dock in the bay, collect a water sample using a process called a net tow, and also just a bucket on the surface. And then we go back to the laboratory at Port Townsend Marine Science Center to process and examine what we have sampled. We're looking for phytoplankton, which can be responsible for harmful algal blooms. This is the acronym is HAB, which result in harm to humans and result in beach closures if the blooms are too severe. And when you see a beach closed for clamming or oystering due to biotoxins, this is what we're talking about, and this is what we're looking for. The project is mounted by NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. It's a huge collaborative effort. Our project is we do weekly from April through October, I think, and then monthly after that. And the whole objective is to attempt to identify a bloom that is potentially harmful as an early warning sign so that steps can be taken to minimize or mitigate the effects of a bloom.
So in this case, because you're sampling weekly, you would be looking at the change 1 week to the next.
Yes, and there's huge change 1 week to the next, depending on salinity of the water. If after rains, when the rivers are all pouring in, there's a difference in the salinity. We look at, of course, temperature of the air and the water, and any of the water contents, at chlorophyll, at nutrients, and the different phytoplankton species. And so there are big changes from week to week. Sometimes there are blooms that are not harmful and they'll be gone the next week. Sometimes there are blooms. There are four primary phytoplankton that we look for careful monitoring. The training, there is a standard protocol for all of this, and volunteers who were not trained scientists can be trained to do this and get good support through the staff, the citizen science staff, and other volunteers at the Port Townsend Marine Science Center.
Does the training carry on year to year? Do circumstances change so that you have to know something different about what you're doing or how you're doing it?
We do have annual training every year in the spring before we start our most intensive monitoring. Mm-hmm. And we go into NOAA, the Seattle Fisheries Research Center at Union Bay, and spend a day or two learning about new species that have been found or just updating, refreshing our protocol knowledge, any changes that there were, getting results of what everybody has seen mm-hmm. and what's happening. So it really is a wonderful way to build understanding of the bigger picture that we as volunteers are fitting into.
That's wonderful. I'm repeating your word, but that is, it is wonderful. And what I'm thinking about is when you're working in Discovery Bay, have you ever had an incident where you've actually found something that has required closing access or?
We have, in fact, have actually found blooms of phytoplankton that produce toxins that resulted in enclosures. Our data are put into context with other data from the surrounding area. The health department is also collecting data on this, and they're looking at tissue samples as well as water samples. And so we feed our data in. It goes in weekly to NOAA from the Port Townsend sites, and NOAA then puts it into the bigger database that gives them knowledge about and shares with the health department what needs to be done as a result of what's being seen.
I think that people may not sometimes understand that when they see a sign that says, don't harvest right now, they may not realize how important that is. You know, sort of say, well, this is annoying. I've got company and we were going to go out and harvest and now we can't, without realizing how much protection there is in what the sampling has done.
Right. These signs are not posted willy-nilly. They are, they're important to pay attention to because at an absolute minimum, you could come away with a case of diarrhea, but there are some toxins, phytotoxins, that can be deadly and can be quite harmful. So it's better to take your guests out to dinner or for a walk on the beach if there's a sign posted and have them come back another day.
That's great. I'm going to wind up reluctantly because I think we could go on, but I had also heard that you sometimes count salmon during the fall runs. Can you tell us a little about that?
You know, this is a very interesting thing to do, and can join the other volunteers with the North Olympic Salmon Coalition, NOSC, and their mm-hmm. website is exactly that, nosc.org. They always are interested in volunteers who go out to identify and count the salmon that are returning to the streams. In our case, we have worked in Chimicum Creek, and in the fall, and when the fish are coming up, we worked on coho. And you go and wade in the water in your hip waders and you look for signs of salmon and their eggs, their nests, which are called reds, R-E-D-D. Count them and observe them and what they're doing. And in our case, we were splashing around near beaver dams in Chimicum Creek, fish looking for ways to get around the dams, and so they're coming over our feet instead.
I'm very much appreciating your sharing this because people who are not involved just may not realize how much it takes to keep our water quality where it needs to be and to learn what we need to learn about what's coming in and what's going out. So I have a great deal of thanks. Now, how can people who are interested learn a little bit more?
Mary, I suggest that we have so many wonderful organizations that are working hard to preserve our unique environment here. And they include, of course, the Port Townsend Marine Science Center and the North Olympic Salmon Coalition and Jefferson Land Trust. And a good place to get your name on an email list is through the Washington State University Cooperative Extension in Jefferson County. And once on that mailing list, you will learn a great deal about all of the opportunities to volunteer with these other organizations and to get involved or learn more about their science programs. We have such a great collaboration of agencies and volunteers and legislators and tribes and
that's great.
Everybody in this area.
Well,
so,
thank you.
There's plenty to do.
That's really wonderful. And thank you so much for sharing this today. I have a different way of looking at Discovery Bay now. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Thanks, Mary.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
The mystery sound is the hermit thrush. And for this, I'm quoting briefly from Bird Note, which gave a perfect hermit thrush description. High in the western mountains and the forests of the north, where even the long summer days stay cool, a beautiful song echoes. Here, the evergreens are narrowly tapered, like a forest of cathedral spires. Singing atop one spire is a hermit thrush. And this is exactly what some of us hiking saw as a hermit thrush sang and sang perched on the top of an alpine fir. The hermit thrush is modest in appearance, robin-shaped, but smaller than a robin. It's mostly brown, has a rust-colored tail, and a pale breast with black spots, but the bird's most distinguished attribute is its song. Walt Whitman made the hermit thrush a center of his mournful elegy on Lincoln's death, when lilacs last in the dooryard bloomed. When he writes it, the lilac, the bird song, and a star combine as powerful symbols. This is what he says about the hermit thrush. In the swamp, in secluded recesses, a shy and hidden bird is warbling a song. Solitary the thrush, the hermit, withdrawn to himself, avoiding the settlements, sings by himself a song. Finally, events. People are spending a lot of time outdoors this time of year. There's one event on June 15th, a potluck and celebration at the Olympic Peninsula Audubon. The speaker will be Dr. Julia Parrish. It's from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. And check the OPAS website for more information. Thanks for listening. We hope you've enjoyed our program of authentic, eclectic, and local news of the natural community where we live. Nature Now airs at noon on Wednesdays with repeats here on KPTZ, Thursdays at 5 p.m., and Saturdays at 11:30 p.m. Recent podcasts are also available on the website at www.kptz.org.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Today's closing music is Scientist by the Dandy Warhols.
Religiously, I'm speaking on the science camps. We gotta live on science alone. I tell you what, mathematically, I'm having it. I wanna live on science alone now. Yeah, religious scientist. Yeah, I am a scientist. Yeah, religious scientist. We gotta live on science alone now. Science alone.